From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Francisco in the Glen Park area.
Sunset. Portola Valley.
I currently reside in Nob Hill.
West Portal.
I live in Russian Hill.
Coming up, we follow an Oakland police commander who's trying to improve the department's public image.
Anytime you get an officer that doesn't do their job or breaks that trust of the community, it's difficult for all of us because it paints us in that broad brush.
Then we go postal with investigative reporter Peter Byrne.
The U.S. Postal Service has a monopoly on the delivery of mail, and it's a very valuable monopoly, and clearly the private sector would like to own that monopoly.
And we blow off some steam with an ancient Japanese art form.
I can come in here, I can hit these drums as hard as I want, and I can yell as loud as I want. And it's totally fine.
We can yell as loud as we want today on Cross Currents! Oakland Police Captain Ricardo Orozco says he's living his dream of being a cop.
One Adam 12, a 211 in progress.
I'm living my dream. Ever since I was a small boy, the show that I always liked to watch as a kid was Adam 12. And it was a story of two Los Angeles police officers and... Once I saw the badge and the black and white car, I was hooked.
These days, living the dream means managing a team of officers in the central part of Oakland. As of June, the city is broken up into five regions, each led by an area commander. A 26-year veteran of the force, Orozco heads the newly formed Area 3, which includes some of the city's most expensive neighborhoods to live in, as well as some of its lower-income ones. Orozco and the other area captains have increasingly become the public faces of OPD, and he says they're showing people a police culture that's changed a lot since he joined the force in the mid-1980s.
It was difficult for us to understand when we're going to crime scenes why people weren't cooperating with us, and so that was challenging. And then on the flip side, now we understood why certain people in certain neighborhoods didn't want to cooperate, not because they didn't want to, but because out of fear, you know, because we're there for an hour or two, and then we leave.
Community police relations are still fraught with tension, but the leadership is trying to turn that around. So what's it like to be a commander at the Oakland Police Department these days? KALW's Kyungjin Lee took a ride with the captain to find out.
7-4, copy that.
You ready to copy? 7583, 1363, 915-108.
7-4.
So what I gave her was I gave her my serial number, I gave her my car number, and I gave her my handheld radio number. So that way, if something were to happen, when I key the mic, they know who's talking.
In an unmarked black Crown Victoria, Captain Ricardo Orozco and I leave police headquarters downtown. We drive around Lake Merritt and head into Trestle Glen, one of the most exclusive neighborhoods in Oakland. People wave to him as we slowly roll through the narrow and windy streets. He's got his window down and he waves back.
Tell me, you know, what you're looking for in this area in comparison to some of the other areas that you patrol.
Because we get burglaries up in this area, so you're just looking for something that stands out or crime trends that you've seen. So just looking for something like that just doesn't feel right.
In some ways, this beat is coming full circle for Orozco. He spent his first 10 years as a patrol officer.
For me, one of the things that I always get pleasure of is when I see little kids and they come up to you and they feel they're happy. They don't feel threatened. They want to interact with you. They want to talk to you.
We turn onto Park Boulevard, and as we drive down the hill, the homes start looking less majestic. I know we're firmly in the flatlands when I start seeing bars on home windows.
The changes in what you're looking for, the styles when you're going from, a lower income or a more affluent neighborhood, does what you're looking for change?
For the most part, no. You're just aware of the neighborhoods that you're going through and where you have more issues or more crime issues that are occurring.
We turn left to International Boulevard, an iconic street that stretches all the way out to Fremont. Colorful mom-and-pop businesses with signs in Vietnamese, Chinese, Spanish, and Cambodian dot the street. And it bustles with Latino, African-American, and Asian folks. Buses are more frequent, as is the bump of car radio speakers. Orozco says one of his biggest problems in this area is that people don't report crimes.
A lot of the victims are not English-speaking, and I know a lot of that has to do with culture, fear of the police, not trusting the system, not understanding the system. And trust me, as a police officer, it can be intimidating too.
Orozco says when he was a young officer starting out, going to court and testifying before a jury for the first time was scary. So, he says, he can imagine what it's like for a non-citizen who can't speak English and doesn't understand the legal system. He speaks Spanish, and he says the department is trying to hire more officers with bilingual skills. Right now, just under a fifth of the force speaks another language that includes Spanish, Chinese, Vietnamese, and even American Sign Language.
And now we're driving down through the San Antonio, an area that I do have robberies, primarily a prostitution too. So that's what this area is known for. I'm not going to drive you through a gang area. This is where we have one of our Latino gangs, Quince, who has been responsible for some shootings, assaults, robberies. So I'm now at 23rd Avenue and East 15th.
It's early Thursday afternoon right now, and the streets are pretty quiet. The radio crackles regularly, but nothing that requires the captain's attention. I ask Orozco, who doesn't live in Oakland, how his job might change if this were his neighborhood.
You know, I've lived in Oakland before, and I'm trying to relate to that. I lived off of Coolidge for some time.
That's in the Fruitvale neighborhood.
No, I don't think there was a difference, because you were seeing the same thing, and at times it almost became difficult because you were almost in work mode still, because you're seeing and still wanting to do things, but you can't because you're off duty. So that's challenging at times too.
There are no more smiles or waves in this part of town. Even in an unmarked car, people notice as we drive by. A group of young men follow us with their eyes until we're out of sight. I sense we're not so welcome here, so I ask Orozco about the deep-seated distrust between the police and the community.
For all of us that want to be here and do a good job, anytime you get an officer that doesn't do their job or breaks that trust of the community, it's difficult for all of us, because it paints us in that broad brush where we're all painted alike.
It's not a vague concern. Many people in this part of town feel like cops can get away with murder.
So again, Latino community, this is the Fruitvale.
We turn left and head northeast, meandering back towards the hills. As we keep talking, Orozco remains firmly positive, emphasizing how the department's made changes to improve service and community relationships, while also addressing internal issues. He says one thing he tells his officers is that they need to be friendly and approachable.
Get the message across that a smile, a hello, goes a long way. You know, I've had officers that have walked with me in different neighborhoods and come back later on and say, that was great. Everybody was like on our side. Yeah, if you get out of the patrol car, that's what happens, you know, and people want to see you in that light.
There's no time to get out of the car, but Orozco tells me about a recent experience he had while walking out in the neighborhood.
There were two gentlemen that were sitting on a chair that were drinking, and waved to them, simple hello, how are you? And they were shocked. You know, they turned around, started to talk to me, letting me know about the problems that were occurring in that neighborhood, what was occurring, passed out my business card, shook my hand. And they were just very happy to hear.
No weapons were seen.
We soon cross the 580 freeway and start ascending the hill. All of a sudden, we're on Skyline Boulevard, overlooking the whole Bay Area. The clear day makes the water and sky seem extra blue. The Bay Bridge and port cranes are tiny and distant, but easy to spot.
Your area is really, really diverse.
I've taken you everywhere.
Yeah.
Reflecting on his job, Orozco says sometimes people see the police as social workers. When I ask what part of the public sector needs to step up to change this, he doesn't hesitate to answer.
Schools. I would say if we put more emphasis or more resources into our schools, I think we would start seeing a transformation. And again, not only the schools, but educating parents, because we have kids that have grown up in families that just generational have been involved in crimes, that have mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, uncles, aunts, that are constantly in the criminal justice system. And in a sense, they almost don't have a chance. And that's not fair. That's not fair to them.
It may take more than just the police to bring Oakland's crime rate down. But for now, area captains like Orozco are charged with building community trust. The question remains whether and how quickly that trust will grow. In Oakland, I'm Kyungjin Lee for Cross Currents.
Have you started seeing cops differently in Oakland? Let us know how on our tip line at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney. We'll head now north of Oakland to the city of Berkeley to cover a controversy over the sale of a historic post office. Earlier this year, demonstrators staged a campout on the steps of the building, which dates back to 1914. They don't want to see it go, but it's part of a much larger plan by the U.S. Postal Service to sell some of its $85 billion real estate portfolio. Investigative reporter Peter Byrne has written a book that explores the rationale behind the sales, taking on the behind-the-scenes issues that are forcing the Postal Service toward bankruptcy. The book is called Going Postal. U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein's husband sells post offices to his friends cheap. Peter Byrne joined me in studio, and I asked him if the problem boils down to the post office's reliance on so-called snail mail.
What you described is the widespread public perception that the internet is killing the post office, which is promoted by top-level officials. However, it's completely untrue. Think about it in this way. People are buying a lot of packages online these days. Who delivers those packages? There has been obviously a drop in the amount of first-class mail that is being sent through stamp buying and through bill paying, because people are communicating more by email. There's something like 25% drop in that. But there's been a concomitant rise in the post office's delivery of packages. So actually, the post office would be in the black were it not for two things. One, first-class mail subsidizes junk mail. Junk mail, which is used mostly by corporations to send you advertising in the mail, does not pay its own way.
Why would they do that? I mean, very few people actually like getting junk mail, and so why would it be cheaper than it actually costs to distribute?
Well, first of all, junk mail works, which is why people send it to you.
Sure, but I mean, if they were charged more for sending out junk mail, then perhaps they wouldn't send as much.
Well, they could be, but the corporations that use junk mail, you know, represented by the Chamber of Commerce primarily and that type of organization, have lobbyists in Washington who spend their entire careers making sure that the Postal Service does not charge, does not raise the rates. The other factor that drove the post office into the red, into a deficit, is the most important factor. In 2006, Congress passed a law at the urging of Daryl Issa of California and
the congressman.
Congressman Daryl Issa, who is very right on the political spectrum, as it were, passed a law requiring the Postal Service to prepay 75 years worth of retirement health care benefits that amounted to about $55 billion, and to prepay it over a 10-year period, which meant that they instantly created a $5.5 billion annual deficit for the Postal Service, which had been profitable, which had been running in the black. Suddenly, it was in the red because it had to borrow money to pay this $5.5 billion annual vigorish, and it ran out of its borrowing capacity. It borrowed $15 billion from a government bank, and then it couldn't borrow anymore, and it stopped actually paying it. But on the books, it's running a deficit, which has given the politicians such as Daryl Issa and others the perfect excuse to say the post office is incompetent, it can't pay its own way, it should be privatized and run by private corporations.
Now that's called the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, which is prepaying 75 years of pensions. Now, in Issa's defense, I mean, we're having all kinds of pension problems at all kinds of levels of government because people are not prepaying these things. So doesn't it make sense on some level if for an organization such as the Postal Service, a governmental entity, to prepay in advance because then they can ensure the future livelihoods of their employees?
Well, first of all, there's no government agency in this country that I know of that requires prepayment, nor any private corporation that would do such a thing. But the main thing is that the U.S. Postal Service has a monopoly on the delivery of mail, and it's a very valuable monopoly, and clearly the private sector would like to own that monopoly.
That's Peter Byrne. He's an investigative reporter who recently published the e-book Going Postal. U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein's husband sells post offices to his friends cheap, which brings us to Richard Blum, U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein's husband's involvement in the sales of post offices around the country.
One of the results of creating this arbitrary and false budget deficit for the post office was that it made it possible for post office officials and others to say, well, we need to raise ready cash. So the post office has an enormous amount of real estate. Only the military has more. So what happened was that in 2011, the post office awarded a contract to CBRE, C.B. Richard Ellis, which is the world's largest commercial real estate firm. The contract was to manage the sale and leasing of all of the post office's $85 billion worth of properties.
What is Richard Blum's relationship with CBRE?
He's the chairman of the board, and his investment group, Blum Capital Partners, owns the most powerful collection of shares. Now, CBRE was charged with selling the post offices to raise ready cash and selling these properties at their fair market value. My investigation showed that CBRE sold 52 properties for $166 million, but they were valued, they were assessed at a value of $232 million. The loss, if you account for some of the ones that were actually sold at the proper values, was approximately $79 million to the public.
Well, why did CBRE sell these properties for so much lower than the fair market value?
That's what I looked at. I was able to attain the deeds of sale on most of the properties and track the local newspapers that were reporting on these deals. And what emerged was that CBRE sold at least 20% of these properties, some very high-value properties, to its own clients, to its own business partners, and in one case, to one of its owners, Goldman Sachs. And it sold them at huge discounts. In a real estate transaction, there's a concept known as arm's length, which means that the buyer has an agent and the seller has an agent. And generally, people don't have the same agent because each agent's duty is to get the best price possible. The buyer wants the highest price. The seller wants the lowest price. So it's like ludicrous to have one agent representing both because he's going to have to favor one or the other in the negotiations.
What's the bottom line? When you connect all these dots, what's your conclusion about what's going on with the U.S. Postal Service?
Well, the Inspector General suggested that there was contract fraud. I'm going to go more than that. I'm going to say that, in my opinion, is that it's a blueprint for an indictment. If there was a political will to indict the individuals that were associated with allowing this to happen, that includes high-ranking post office officials, it would be a dynamite case.
That was Peter Byrne, author of the e-book Going Postal. U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein's husband sells post offices to his friends cheap. You can find a link to his work at kalw.org. Just click on Cross Currents. Now it's time for Artery, cultural coverage that marches to the beat of its own drum.
taiko. It's a traditional Japanese drumming art form. You could find it here in the Bay Area, where Japanese-American young people take it up as a way of connecting with their roots. But taiko is also assuming a place in American culture, much like karate and kung fu have. Its artistic and physical nature appeals to Northern Californians who are looking to de-stress and tone up. Reporter April Demboski has more in the story from our archives.
Drummer Ryan Kimura was only 9 years old when he first discovered taiko. When he talked about this Japanese art form to a group of high schoolers,
I told everyone to close their eyes, right, and listen to their heartbeats and imagine everybody's heartbeat coming together for one huge sound. And they said, that's really what taiko feels like to me.
Kimura has been doing taiko now for 20 years, but only on the side. He makes a living with his photo booth business in Japantown. Kimura is mild-mannered and modest, even a little shy at times. But he says at least once a week, taiko lets him express another side of his personality.
I can come in here, I can hit these drums as hard as I want, and I can yell as loud as I want, and it's totally fine.
Kimura plays at the San Francisco Taiko Dojo. Taiko Grandmaster Seiji Tanaka opened it in 1968. Back then, Tanaka's aim was to preserve this drumming, traditionally used in agricultural rituals.
Ancient people believe the effort bring the message to the thunder god, to bring rain to the ground.
But Tanaka has since helped taiko evolve into a modern-day hobby that fits in pretty well here in Northern California. The people who flee to yoga to de-stress after working behind a desk all day might just as well flee to taiko.
So here, South San Francisco, our dojo location is very close to a computer company, Valley, Silicon Valley or all those. So I think most students doing the computer all day, you know, same thing, blah, 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 blah. Computer, they don't talk back, right? So come here, we communicate each other, and very, very end screaming. So a lot of people are stressed and all those things out by playing drum. Especially taiko dojo is not only beating drum, but breathing exercise to make your mental care and physical care both. So I think very healthy taiko therapy, almost.
The physical training for playing the drums is intense. Students start class with a half-hour run around the industrial park. Then they do a series of stretches, push-ups, and sit-ups.
At the beginning, it's really important that when we warm up, we breathe together. That way it gets all of our bodies in line with each other.
Then they move on to practicing different rhythms on the drums, sometimes with choreography. Ryan Kimura says taiko has helped him mature, mentally, spiritually, and physically.
When I was younger, I had asthma. I was always in the hospital, staying overnight. It was terrible. You know, I did kung fu, and that helped me kind of get my body in shape. And then I started taiko, and it really got me in shape. I was kind of this round little ball at the time. Now I have a little bit of muscle, and I've lost that baby fat, so it's nice.
In fact, his lean physique has been the centerpiece of the group's promotional poster. A recent photo captures him performing. He's midair, playing an enormous one-ton taiko drum, wearing a traditional loincloth.
Yeah, it was quite strange, actually, quite embarrassing for me.
In the poster, Kimura is playing the finale of a composition called Tsunami. Members of the dojo have performed it for audiences many times since Master Tanaka wrote it almost 20 years ago.
Tsunami is like a tidal wave, right? So tsunami is very dynamic, big power, like a go for broke. This is my spirit. So the passion, like a fire, like a tornado, But the tsunami also make a trouble.
And it definitely builds like a tidal wave, right? It starts off, but at the end when it ends with the solos, it's just going back and forth between solos, soloists. When I'm playing Tsunami, I notice that I don't think about anything. So everything I do on stage, I really don't remember sometimes because the song kind of takes over.
The drummers hope the same will happen for those watching because for them, it is about so much more than listening. They want audiences to hear, watch, and feel Taiko. In San Francisco, I'm April Domboski for Cross Currents.
You can see Taiko drumming performed live this weekend at Zollerbach Hall on the UC Berkeley campus. The San Francisco Taiko Dojo joins special guests from Japan for the 45th International Taiko Festival. Find more details at kalw.org. That's all for today's edition of Cross Currents. The team includes David Boyer, Jeremy Dalmas, Audrey Dilling, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Liz Pfeffer, Seth Samuel, Stephen Short, and Mary Willis. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our senior producer is Martina Castro. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thanks to you, we're listener-supported radio. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.